Blog Talk Radio.
Now, PW Torch and Spreaker bring you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's AEW Dynamite on TNT.
Well, Eric, this is one of those shows where I think we could start in a few places, but I want to start with Jungle Boy Jack Perry and his first official heel promo. He turned on Hook at Forbidden Door, and we heard Tarzan Boy for the last time. I hear it's no longer available on Spotify or Apple Music either. Jungle Boy Jack Perry said the fans ruined that song for him. They can't hear it anymore. And then he entered the ring and cut kind of generic heel promo, one-on-one, insulting the city, yelling at the fans to shut up, some awkward pauses that weren't great cadence-wise. But I didn't watch going, this guy's not a heel, he's miscast, and this will never work. I actually think, with some repetition, that he might be a little more comfortable in this because it's frankly easier to be a heel than a face. And Perry, was unintentionally cutting heel promos sometimes as a babyface. I think this showed promise, but he's got a ways to go. Well, I'm curious for your assessment.
Well, I was surprised they gave him a live mic because that's not something they often did with him as a baby face. Jack Perry has, I think he said in an interview within the last month or two, that he is uncomfortable doing the promos, right? They're not his favorite thing. He likes doing the in-ring action. I'm curious to see when he has a match. His style was pure baby face, right? He had that high-flying, a lot of action style, and that is a baby face style, not a heel style, so I'll be interested to see how, if at all, he changes his in-ring style. He did get heat. I will say that. So you can't say he didn't get over as a heel. He did have heat. It wasn't go-away heat. It was, actual boos. My notes say he should have just said what he would have said when he was a babyface, right? That was often, as you noted, unintentionally heelish. I personally could have done without the second segment back, WWE-style segment, backstage involving someone getting away in a car, driving in an SUV. Two in one show is just maybe one too many. Even though the heel running away from the face and driving away in a waiting limo or SUV backstage is a time honored wrestling tradition. I guess I'm maybe a 6 out of 10 on it, and not throwing in the towel on Jungle Boy as a heel. Give him the reps, as you say, and let's see what he can do.
And I think part of this is developing a heel style against an opponent that fans are going to be behind. That'll make it easier. Hook is green, Jungle Boy is not, but Jungle Boy is untested as a heel. But I think they're real life friends, so I think they're going to, and you don't have to be to put it together a good match, but I think they'll be looking out for each other, and hopefully they are, with the pedigree of Hook with Taz and Jungle Boy being a big fan, and I think being interested in getting better and learning, I mean, this is an important test for both of them in very different ways. It's a test for Hook to work his first full-fledged grudge singles feud. They've been protecting him so much in tag matches, and just he hasn't been around. And Perry, is going to have to show not only can he get by on the microphone as a heel and show promise, but that translates to him being a heel in the ring. The one concern I have about his heel work, besides what you said, which is what's left when you take away the moves that people like to cheer and admire the athleticism, and it's exciting, is does he approach being a heel the same way he did the promo, which is the physical movement equivalent of insulting the city and yelling shut up? Like, do we get him just sort of doing heel 101 tactics that feel sort of stilted and put on and not really in the flow? If that happens, he's going to get the wrong kind of heat. Now, he's been really good as a babyface in the ring, so I don't have any particular reason to doubt he can have good matches. It's how does he project the heel persona in the course of the match effectively so that it doesn't seem incongruent that we're supposed to boo him when he's out there having a really good match with Hook. I think in the promo, body language-wise, facial expression, kind of an arrogance to him, I think he can make it work. But, you know, it might look performance. It might look like he's trying to be a heel instead of just being a heel, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So we'll see. I don't want to get too far ahead on things. But they want him to be a big star. And I think his, like with a lot of wrestlers, the growth comes character-wise from leaving a lane that wasn't working really well, and his babyface promos were not working well. That's not his comfort zone. And giving him something else to do that might be a little more fun, a little more out-of-body experience where he can kind of play the role of somebody else or tap into a part of him that has a little more charisma. So I'm on board. I was leery. I think like most people, to some degree, we're leery of such a natural babyface turning heel. But I'm guardedly encouraged by tonight based on the wide range of possibilities that could have happened. Are you kind of in that same spot?
I thought that the heel turn was a bit rushed. I didn't feel like they laid enough groundwork for it. You could tell they were starting to with Jack Perry calling Hook his best friend. That's always the red flag in wrestling. But, I wonder, maybe they had this planned all along, but I do wonder if I was in at the Wintrust Arena last Wednesday for the Dynamite taping. And then this would have been the Rampage taping afterward when he took on Dookie from New Japan in a match that was the main event of Rampage last week. And, Jack Perry got booed and the crowd was into Dookie, whether the crowd, I mean, I know who he is, but he's not like one of, you got to be a pretty hardcore New Japan fan to sort of, you got to watch more than the major shows to sort of know who he is and have a feel for him. I think, it seemed to me that the fans in Chicago were just cheering Dookie because his name is Dookie, which, kind of a joke there. But they did boo Perry, and I wonder if that was the catalyst that they said, okay, let's just go with this thing now. But I thought they could have let the story develop a little bit more, a little bit longer.
Yeah, yep. Fair comments. But, we talk a lot about Perry. I'm interested if this is a launching point for Hook, too. I think his demeanor was good coming out and then turning on the Jets and chasing Perry away. We're not getting a lot from him. I don't know that we want to get a lot from him, but the glimpses we get of him have to stay in a lane where your fans are going to turn on him and cheer Jungle Boy. And I don't think we're at risk of that. I think Hook still has the cool factor, but if he breaks too much from it, there's always risk the wheels come off a little bit of what made the character appealing in the first place. So anyway, yeah, go ahead.
Do you dish Hook his, I think he's undefeated still, right? I don't think he's taken a fall yet in AEW. They don't make a big deal about that, but he's not looking up at the lights. I don't think he has at all. Do they sacrifice Hook's undefeated streak that they don't make a big deal out of at the altar of trying to get Jungle Boy over, right? With the thinking that Hook is even younger than Jungle Boy and has more years to get over. And you could really cement Jungle Boy as a heel if he were to cheat to beat Hook. Or do they just end up with Jungle Boy winning the first one and Hook winning a return match in some way to get to be 50-50? Well, I'll be curious to see how that unfolds.
Yeah, and not to undercut your question at all, because Hook is undefeated, 33-0. I don't think it matters a lot because of, I guess it was baked in your question, which is they haven't made a big deal out of it. Sometimes getting that first loss is good because, the whole undefeated thing can actually just kind of be a distraction or that's all anyone's focused on. So just giving him a loss to Jungle Boy and Jungle Boy bragging, I gave you your first loss because you finally faced somebody, good, whatever, he hopefully doesn't just use that language. He can be a little more descriptive. To me that works, but you could also have Hook just, surprise an arrogant Jungle Boy who's too wrapped up in being a heel, yell at the crowd. Hook rolls him up and applies a submission. Not to get too micro, but you could do something where like Jungle Boy taps as his foot drapes the bottom rope, and the ref sees the tap out, but Jungle Boy just goes around claiming his foot was on the rope first. Like, in other words, you have a disputed finish of some kind where Hook gets the win, but the heat on Jungle Boy, because there's a danger in having him be a winner as a heel. But you don't want to diminish him too much either. So he could take a loss that was almost not a loss and then claim he didn't lose, and then a lot more heat comes from that. And then you actually keep the Hook undefeated streak alive, and then you actually do play into it. And then when Perry finally actually beats Hook, then Perry can, you know, brag a lot about that. So that's what I mean. I mean, I just think there's a lot of possibilities here. It's not a main event match, like on a pay-per-view, but if they build this right, Hook doesn't wrestle that much. Perry's first match is a heel. I think they could build a Dynamite around that as a centerpiece match.
If Perry wants to learn how to do heel promos, he has no shortage of really good heel promos in the back to go ask, right?
Yeah.
Chris Jericho springs to mind. Bryan Danielson, maybe on technique, maybe how to wrestle as a heel. CM Punk, Samoa Joe, Moxley. Probably, you know, I don't know. Moxley might give him tips. I don't know that he can do a Moxley style promo because he's not a tough guy. But you know, no shortage of people who could take him under their wing and say, hey, you know, let me help you develop your heel persona. If AEW seeks to make that happen, or if Jack himself seeks to make that happen.
Yeah. Yep. All right. Well, we got a lot more to talk about. Let's pause. Let's introduce ourselves quickly, and then we'll get to calls and see where they lead us. And we'll certainly touch on all the follow-up to Forbidden Door and the other happenings on the show, including Sting and Jericho battling in the tag match in the main event with Darby and Sammy, also with a big table spot that Sting sort of pulled off. We'll get into that. This is the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show for Wednesday, June 28th, 2023. I'm Wade Keller, the host of the show, the editor, publisher, founder of Pro Wrestling Torch, including the weekly print newsletter, the website pwtorch.com, and the host of various podcasts, including the weekly Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast flagship. Yesterday, Javier Machado joined me, I think for the first time ever on the flagship, and we talked a lot of Forbidden Door. We did an in-depth preview of Money in the Bank. We talked Collision, Week 2 ratings, and CM Punk in general. So check that out. That's on our Blue Logo show. If you're not subscribing to that, it's also free. It's just on a separate feed because it's not the live call-in format that we do here on the post show. It's a more traditional pre-tape podcast. And you can check that out. And also on the feed are some of our best of interviews, some classic interviews we've done over the years, long-form interviews with big-name wrestlers, ex-WWE writers, and more. We sprinkle those in throughout the week along with some other flashbacks. So check that out. The latest episode is up with Javier Machado, about 2 hours, give or take, discussing current events. But tonight we're here to talk AEW Dynamite, and my co-host, the voice you've heard so far other than mine, is Eric Kroll, a Pro Wrestling Torch columnist emeritus it used to be 20 years ago. Now it's over 20 years ago, and going on 25 almost, man. And now he's back contributing periodically to pwtorch.com with written articles. He is a professional trained, practice experienced journalist. And AEW and New Japan brought him back into wrestling after some time away, spending more time raising his family than watching WWE during the John Cena era. Some would say you didn't miss anything, Eric, but you did. But you chose a good time to come back. Welcome. Your kids chose a good time to turn into like teenagers and grow up where you have more time, because this is there's no shortage of good wrestling to watch compared to 10 years ago.
Yes, sometimes watching AEW like last week feels like a part-time job.
Oh, God.
On the flagship podcast, did you play a special song for Javier? And if so, did you spend $100,000 for the rights to that song?
No, I didn't. Mike Myers does a good job providing free music for us. So. So welcome, Eric.
Thank you.
All right, so let's give out the phone number. We've got four people on hold. You can be fifth if you call right now. 347-215-8558. That's 347-215-8558. When you call push 1, that flags you on our switchboard so that we know you want to be on the show. You can also just call and listen in if that's easier, and then hit 1 if you are so inspired as the conversation continues. You can also email us at wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. All right. Let's go first to Chris in Oklahoma. He is a VIP Express caller, a VIP member who has reserved the number one position. Chris, good to hear from you again. Welcome. What's on your mind about tonight's Dynamite?
I have two comments and one question. Two comments. I thought this is the best Dynamite there's been in a long time. a lot of spent, and a lot of stuff was tied up, you know, a lot of storylines, and that's something you really don't see. Also, this is the first time, and correct me if I'm wrong, the first time that Renee Paquette and Jon Moxley have been seen on TV together. Is that true? On AEW?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I have a memory of a somewhat flirtatious interview between them, and it wasn't the Renee podcast clip where they showed off each other's inner thighs and legs and ankles to compare who had sexier legs, which I believe actually happened. It wasn't just a fever dream. But Eric, I recall Renee holding the microphone for Moxley and there being sort of a you wouldn't know if you didn't know, but if you do know, you can kind of tell moment.
I don't recall that happening. I know one time Hangman Page was interviewed by Renee in the middle of the feud with Moxley, and that led to some, you know, intentionally awkward moments. I don't recall Renee and John interacting on TV in an angle type situation like they did tonight before, for sure. That's the first time I can recall that.
Yeah, for sure, as far as the angle goes, yeah. Yeah, I could be wrong. And Chris, if you are a avid watcher, and you probably would remember if it happened, so maybe I'm imagining something. Eric, what did you think, by the way, of the interaction and Renee getting worked up in the context of Eddie, you know, talking like that to her husband?
I feel like I missed or don't know the backstory behind why she said, "That's it, I'm done," right? There may have been groundwork laid at some point, and I just missed it, but I didn't understand why she did. It seemed to imply prior events between the three of them that I'm not privy to.
I was just kind of thinking, but maybe there is more to it. I just thought she's like, I'm done with this. I don't want to stand around as this guy yells at my husband and I have to try to be professional. I just thought she was just kind of at wit's end from the whole, you know, everything breaking down and how in the escalation of things. And she's just like, I'm not going to be here for this. Chris, back to you. What was your impression?
Well, my impression was that she was like, to me, it seemed like she was done with the whole, you know, like you said, she's done with the whole thing, Eddie Kingston getting on Moxley and, you know, Moxley, she's going to defend her husband, but also, you know, this whole feud with Claudio and Moxley, I think she's also done with that, you know, as well. And it could be, I mean, that's the whole premise of this, is that there was some sort of heat between Claudio and Eddie Kingston from a long time ago. They even mentioned it at the one of the first, like, big matches. I can't remember which one it was. Moxley, Kingston, and Jericho was a part of that. There was, like, some big heat. And that's the only thing I can think of, is that she was trying to say, okay, not again. We're not doing this.
Okay. Yeah.
I
mean, that could
actually,
be good. Yeah.
I have some explanation as to what they're doing here, right, with this.
Yeah.
So Eddie Kingston is about to leave July 15th. The G1 Round Robin tournament starts in New Japan Pro Wrestling. So Eddie's going to be gone. But what I think they're doing is they're setting up an ROH main event world title match between Claudio and Kingston, which would take place on, I think it's Friday, July 21st. That is the next ROH pay-per-view. And Kingston's schedule in New Japan, he can make it, right? He is wrestling, I think he's wrestling on the 19th and then not again until the 23rd. So he could fly back, do the ROH title match on the pay-per-view, which would be a rematch of the last pay-per-view main event or world title match, and then fly back to Japan. So I think that's what they're trying to do here, which is, you know, also Kingston is going to face off against Ishii in the G1 tournament. They're in the same block, the C block. There are four blocks, A, B, C, and D, groups of eight wrestlers. Those four blocks, they'll each have seven matches, all fighting each other once. And this seems like a long way to go to set up an ROH world title match, but I guess they're trying to do it now because Kingston will be less available the closer he gets to having to depart for Japan. And that's what I think is going on. He can't, obviously, so they announced Blood and Guts tonight.
Yeah.
And it's July 19th, so Kingston will be, I think he's wrestling New Japan wrestler Evil that night, so he's not going to be around. So it's not going to be in the Blood and Guts match. You know, if it ends up being 4-on-4, you know, Brian Danielson, they have Takeshita. Brian Danielson can't be involved because he's got a broken arm. So does that match just be 4-on-4? I always assume that's when AEW is going to debut Kota Ibushi coming in to help the Elite win this feud. But if not, you know, then that would mean the Blackpool Combat Club would need one more person. So that's kind of where I, a little bit of context for what I think they're doing here and looking ahead.
Yeah, that's good. I hope people took notes because now I feel stressed from Tony Khan's scheduling, trying to make up for Danielson's arm injury and Kingston's Japan dates and making Blood and Guts live up to what people's expectations are. But that was very useful information, and I'm sure they got it all figured out going into this. The idea of having an ROH match you're hyping, but doing so in what feels a little confusing for people who aren't familiar with the backstory. They kind of have to piece it together as we go and listen carefully to off-mic yelling and announcer comments. But the idea of like building up an ROH pay-per-view main event on Dynamite, but doing so in kind of a sneaky way, that also fits with the Moxley situation, works for me. I think that you know, because it is, you know, the announcers have said this is a grudge from ROH, and I think they threw out the comment about back something happening at Chikara years ago and get over it. So you kind of have to just watch and piece it together, but in a way that can kind of feel like this isn't scripted. It's not supposed to be happening. It's not just like a standard build. This is just people who can't not yell at each other. And there's all kinds of personal issues, and they're not performing for the camera. They're just letting their emotions flow. And it is different, and I think it stands out, even if there's a little bit of downside because it isn't just laid out as clearly as, say, Jungle Boy Hook, where it's like he turned on him, and he's sick of him, and now he's going to fight him. Chris, back to you.
Mm-hmm. One last thing. The Adam Cole and MJF segment had me laughing so hard. I want to buy that shirt so bad because it just fits so well for them. I'm just curious. I really am curious because would you have Adam Cole go over? Because he's been in two matches with one match for the championship. He's been in one match that was for a shot at the championship and went in a draw of it. Does he have to be MJF at the end of all this for it to be him be in a good situation? Or do you protect MJF enough to make it where, okay, we can make it work either way?
It is it is part of being a good booker is knowing how to transition out of a feud, and especially if the babyface is losing, end up with that babyface having something else to do that distracts fans from the fact that he came up short. You can't have every babyface protected from losing to a heel world champion by having them beat the heel world champion. You have to decide that's who you really want to win. So, Eric, who do you think wins a feud? Does Cole beat MJF for the title? Do you think that's a trajectory they might be on or are likely on? And if not, you know, as Chris brings up, if MJF cheats to win and then Cole just moves on to something else, I mean, I guess they could do that. What do you think?
Well, it sure seems like they're going to stretch this feud out all or all in from London. And I would think that's where they are aiming this match for. I suppose they could blow it off on TV beforehand, but they got to do it soon enough to set up an MJF challenger for All In and then All Out a week later. So when they built that reality show, the behind-the-scenes all-access show, around Adam Cole and his comeback from the concussion, I thought, wow, they're really kind of trying to strap the rocket to this guy. And then, you know, they got a whole summer to fill if this isn't the match they're doing until London. And I thought maybe they were gonna, you know, give the big push to Cole and have him be the one that beat MJF. But I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not feeling it right now. That's
yeah. I'm not there yet. I mean, so I think what they're better off in London with 65,000, you know, before any matches are even announced, 65,000 fans. If you're going to have MJF lose the belt, lose it there so that you have, you know, you have the new champion gets to have the iconic image of raising the belt with 65,000 fans or more, mm-hmm. you know, going nuts for him. You know, you get the iconic moment, you get the big rub. But I don't know that Adam Cole is that guy. I mean, he might be. I mean, he's been at the top everywhere he's gone because he's got that kind of charisma and persona. But, you know, then we've got a week later, there's All Out in Chicago at the United Center, which as soon as I heard they moved it from an arena that would seat, I don't know, maybe 9,000, 10,000 fans, depending on how large the set was, to the United Center where they could pack 14,000, 15,000 in, depending on what size set they use, I thought, oh, well, they're clearly going to have MJF and Punk at the United Center. And is this going to be where Punk reclaims the belt? Or, you know, last year MJF in one of his early promos against Punk laid out a roadmap and said he was going to deal him his worst loss in the history of his life, which I assume to mean the original plan was MJF beating Punk for the belt at All Out in Punk's hometown last year, which obviously didn't happen because MJF took the summer off for to get really, really bulky and huge and defined, or, you know, whether it was a work or a shoot, you know, him no-showing the Fan Fest at Double or Nothing 2022, and then Punk got injured. So they didn't have that, and they, you know, then Punk got suspended after Brawl Out. And or maybe he got suspended. He certainly was kept from AEW. I don't think they've ever said that. He was kept away from AEW TV while he recovered for 9 months. And so, you know, are they going back to MJF and Punk with Punk winning this one at All Out? I don't know. But that's, you know, those are my thoughts and notes. To answer Chris's question, yeah, it's going to be bad for Adam Cole because he will have lost twice in title matches, one at pay-per-view, I think one televised to Hangman Page when he had the belt, and then now he will have lost, well, I guess a draw and a loss to MJF if he doesn't win the belt. So he will mm-hmm. he'll get two big pushes and failed to win the big one. So
I think that's all. Those are all key factors, but if you are more committed to MJF's title reign and a CM Punk match for the title, Cole's record spread out over a couple of years is less important than, you know, staying the course with what you think is a bigger money match. And certainly MJF and Punk is a bigger match right now than MJF and Cole. But I think they're trying to develop a chemistry, a comedic dynamic between them, but not one where they become genuine friends. Eric, what did you think of kind of chapter one in this, of MJF telling Cole to come hang with him and Cole going, what the heck? And then later telling Roderick Strong, yeah, I'm just playing along. Did you find them amusing like Chris did? And do you think this has potential to provide minutes of entertainment every week for a while?
The jury's still out. It's early on. It's not my cup of tea. I would prefer the champion not be in shticky stuff, but that, you know, MJF is kind of MJF. My favorite part of the whole segment was MJF walking in and calling Roderick Strong generic white guy. I'm not big time for that. Tell me when I'm telling lies.
Exactly,
you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm willing to see where it goes. They're both talented performers. I hope they don't end up singing Broadway show tunes and tap dancing and breaking the reality, you know, breaking the fourth wall in the middle of a show like Jericho and MJF did when they did their shtick. You know, we'll see. What Chris liked the segment. Wade, you liked it.
I was for it when it was established they were going to be a tag team. I think it gives them. I think. The dynamic between them can be entertaining. I want, as you said, them to be entertaining in a way that's true to each other's characters, that doesn't get too cutesy, and leads to and has a kind of a finish line that intensifies the feud. But I kind of have faith they're going to pull it off and make it work without any eye rolling stuff that's just too cute for its own good. I think there's potential without them having to go in that area.
I mean, I think it's one of those old sitcom-y setups of, I know that you know that he knows that I know that I'm trying to screw him over, right? And vice versa.
Exactly, so, yeah.
That's why I'm willing to let it, you know, not pass judgment right away.
Yeah. Chris, anything else quick? We have a lot of people on hold, so I want to move on.
Really quick, that bump on the table by Sting, I don't know who gave him an authorization to do that, but I wish they would not do that to him.
Yes. Chris, thank you. Oh, go ahead.
It looked cringe. And I mean, I was looking at it. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, guys.
Chris, I agree. Yeah, thank you, Chris. Always good talking to you. I am not thrilled with Sting seeming in his 60s to be on some sort of path where he constantly has to prove himself by doing things that, you know, are tempting fate. You know, he came up a little short on the dive onto Guevara onto two tables and appeared to hit his chin, maybe his teeth, on Guevara's knee when he came up a little short. And, you know, it's just, you don't want to be just like the parent at the spelling bee who's like, oh, I hope my kid spells it right. But that's how I am when I watch Sting decide he's going to climb to the top rope and do something really athletic. And they don't talk about his age, and he looks like Sting from 30 years ago. It's insane. You know, I just, you know, his body's covered up for the most part. He's got the face paint on. He's still got the same jawline and eyes and swagger. So it works, but, like, you don't have to do that stuff. Now, that said, this, I think what – even though he came up a little short, this is on the lower end and more safe. It's more controlled. You've got, you know, Darby holding the ladder steady and Sting pushing off. And going back to when I first saw Sting in the late 80s, the big thing about him when he was on WCW Saturday Night was that spring in his legs. And, you know, a muscular guy with incredible leaping power, and that's where the Stinger Splash came from. But that's something that's not out of what he normally does, is my point. So I give him credit for wanting to keep proving himself, and I want to say that I think this was one of the low risk moves, but it still ended up with, you know, his jaw, I think, hitting Guevara's knee. So I think Sting can do, you know, dial it down and not have to prove himself because people are going to love him anyway, and stick to some of the safer moves that are just signature spots for him. Eric, what do you think?
I'm not in favor of 64-year-olds making those kind of leaps.
Yeah, I think that's a very reasonable stance to take. All right, we're going to go to Jay in Michigan, but Jay just dropped off. So up next, we'll go to Keith in Virginia. Jay, call us back if you want. Keith, welcome. What's on your mind tonight about Dynamite?
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Good. Good to talk to you.
Yeah. I guess you guys already touched on it, but the whole Sting thing. Watching that, I thought maybe I didn't know how it was going to go, and then I saw that Sting was going to do the dive, and I was worried. And then once he hit it, I had an unexpected emotion, which was anger. I don't care to see a 60-year-old man kill himself on television. You know, I've been a fan of Sting, but I still haven't seen him live. And selfishly, I would like to before he retires. But why? What a fundamental lack of leadership there is to let that happen. Like, who's running the show is what I'm wondering. It's just wildly irresponsible.
Yeah.
It took me out of it.
Yeah, Keith. No, I don't blame you. I mean, that has been a consistent issue, Eric, in terms of, is there anyone around saying no to either overly dangerous spots by young guys or sufficiently dangerous spots for somebody in his 60s, and just going, you know what, we don't need you to do that. You're getting paid either way. The fans love you. Let's not do that. I am quite sure nobody's encouraging Sting to do this, like, and he's nervous. I think this is him going, I want to do it. I can do it. I want to prove I can do it. But that said, you still, you know, I mean, Tony Khan's a 40, 41-year-old guy telling a guy he grew up watching who's 24 years older than him, no, I'm going to overrule you. But that is the job of a boss, Eric, right? You got to go, we don't need you doing this because it's not needed and it could be really bad for fans to watch you get hurt live on TV.
Yeah, I don't know what AEW's backstage approval process is. You know, someone's agenting the match, one of the producers. Do they run past, you know, risky stuff like that past Tony Khan? And is he in a position beforehand to say yes or no? I guess you would argue if he didn't say no, he should have. If he isn't asked, he probably should be, right? Mm-hmm. It's his company, and he ultimately, the buck stops with him. I, you know, especially after they dodged a bullet on Sunday at Forbidden Door when Sting got, looked like he, when Sammy came off the top rope, I think when Sting maybe had Jericho in a hold, he first hit Sting, and Sting looked like he got kind of dazed there. I don't know. I don't know if it was a blown spot or somebody moved too early. But then even more so than that, I think Sting clearly was supposed to get off that table Sunday night when Sammy Guevara did the 630 off the top, you know, off the top to the outside. And I don't know if he forgot or didn't move fast enough or, you know, was slow. But it sure looked like he was trying to get up. And then Sammy just, the timing was off and just, you know, crushed him through that table.
And then Sting wanders aimlessly in the middle of the match to his car instead of walking around, seeming like he's out of it.
So you dodged a bullet there. Why tempt Sting, I guess?
Yeah.
Why have Sting do this? Just, you know, what's Rich fans' phrase? Is the juice worth the squeeze? I would say
no. Yes. Keith, back to you. Can you elaborate on that or bring up something else?
No, that was basically it. I mean, you combine that with certain other things that have happened, and, you know, you could, going back to that whole Matt Hardy incident where he, you know, got hurt, somebody's going to really get injured. And, I mean, what's going to be the who's going to be the one to take responsibility for that? Or are they just going to, you know, pass the buck like other things? But anyway, that's all I had. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thanks. Appreciate it, Keith. I think it's a reasonable concern, and the more people who express it to Tony in various forms might, you know, cause Tony to think, maybe I ought to step in here. You know, I know Sting's a legend and he's, you know, could be my dad, but I gotta step up and let him know there's some risk here. And I don't is the juice worth the squeeze? You know, probably not. Especially because Sting can just be Sting. That's not what he's known for. He can jump, but he's known for the Stinger Splash and the Scorpion Death Drop and all that, and just stop trying to be, you know, Jeff Hardy in TNA, where it's like, where's a high place I can jump off of to test myself? All right. Let's go to the Toronto area here. Eric with 647. Go ahead, state your name and where you're calling from.
Hey, Wade. This is Chris and Katie coming back from Hamilton, back to Toronto.
Awesome. Thanks for calling. I assume you attended the show and weren't just happened to be in Hamilton driving back from to Toronto.
Yeah, we actually went to all three so far. This is our third.
Awesome. Well, tell us about it. What stood out tonight to you?
I don't want to. Do you have a correspondent? I don't want to step on their feet.
No, we actually did. So it's great you called in. We didn't have anyone lined up.
It's me.
Last time.
It's us. Okay.
Yeah, yes, you
well,
are.
Well,
yep, you guys are.
It was a great show. There were some concerns about the attendance. It was fine enough. Did it look okay on TV?
It did. There were times it sounded, Eric, like if someone sneezed, everyone would hear it. You know, like it had a little bit of a sense that the building wasn't full. Eric, how did it come across to you?
I thought the crowd was very loud for lots of the show, which was impressive because I was doing some research on WrestleTix today, and I saw that they only had about 4,300 tickets distributed, which is in a building that's capacity might be 17,000 for a hockey game, and you know maybe 13,000 with a wrestling stage set up. So it's interesting that, you know, the camera angles seem designed to only shoot half the building. Chris, was the half the building just pretty much empty tonight? Like nobody in any of the seats?
The lower bowl was probably 40% full and got a little thin towards the top of the lower bowl. But like you said, they just kept the shots tight, and where we were right behind hard cam was full, and it didn't seem like a problem. I thought the crowd was actually pretty good.
Yeah, they chose the right camera angle. I paid attention to that because I knew the crowd was on the lower end for Dynamite TV event, and I don't think it took away from the show other than, I would say, when there was heel heat and boos, it sounded, relatively speaking, like there wasn't a lot of heat, that the heat was lower than it would be for a wrestler who's really over. So I think that had to do with just the size of the crowd and just a little bit of a sense of kind of maybe an echo. But overall, I didn't think about it much. It didn't take away from the show. But it also didn't add to the show. Like, I don't think this would come across as a red-hot crowd that really elevated things.
I also do have a CM Punk versus Elite fan update.
Yes.
Surprisingly, the Elite not well-received in Hamilton, which I'm assuming was – it did seem like a lot more families, a lot more locals. So that's something to watch in the future. CM Punk seemed – it was much more favorable towards CM Punk, which was obviously not the case in Toronto. So that's something to watch.
What was the context of Punk getting a reaction from Punk? Just the video package there?
Well, no. Well, what happened was during the Elite match, people were trying to get the CM Punk chants going again. And as usual, not going to lie, we're Team Punk or Team Elite. So we were drowning them out, trying to drown them out. But it wasn't working as well this time. So the Elite was being booed. There was one interesting part where the CM Punk chants were getting crazy. So we did an Elite chant. And Hangman, we're about 10 rows up, and Hangman looked right at us and was like, yeah, and encouraging us. So he knew what was happening. But we definitely weren't in Toronto anymore. Definitely not in Toronto anymore. It was a much more, quote-unquote, flyover-type crowd that you might see in the middle America.
Interesting. Yeah. I'm not quite sure what to make of it, but I didn't really have any firm prediction other than I knew Chicago is going to cheer for Punk. Well, we didn't know that because they were chanting MJF last time we saw him after Punk's title win, but I figured they would cheer him. And then Toronto, as noted, and you're pointing out too, wasn't just a Toronto crowd. It was, I need to see these New Japan wrestlers in person, and it was a big travel crowd, and it's, driving distance from a lot of major cities in the U.S., so not to mention people flying in. So it's hard to, it's hard to draw a conclusion from that other than maybe the most informed hardcore fans who are willing to travel are more anti-punk outside of Chicago. People are just going to cheer, I guess, who they perceive as a bigger star, even if it doesn't happen to be at that event. Yeah, interesting. Eric, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I was a little bit surprised to hear the Elite get some boos. I couldn't tell if that was because Evil Uno is from Canada, and there's always the weird, and even though the Dark Order were the heels in this match, or were supposed to be, I didn't know if the weird, the Bret Hart weird Canadian dynamic, U.S. dynamic, where Bret Hart's cheered in Canada and booed in the U.S. When he was a heel, was at play here. Like, were people into Evil Uno because he's Canadian, or do you think, Chris?
There was a bit of that, but it was just, I think people just didn't like the Elite. And I was really surprised at that, but like you said, I think that makes a lot of sense. This weekend, it was a lot of traveling fans, the New York, Philadelphia, Toronto type people. And even though Hamilton's only like an hour from Toronto, it's basically its own city and it's not Toronto. So that'll be interesting to watch going forward.
Is Hamilton at all, like, I don't know enough about the Canadian major cities and provinces and how they react to each other, but is there any kind of anti-Winnipeg vibe in Hamilton or the Toronto area, like, where they'd be like, well, we're not into, any of them?
It's basically Long Island to New York City. It's a glorified suburb. But this looked to be all local people, maybe people from Buffalo, maybe people from more central Ontario, and a lot of families. I don't think I saw one kid all weekend. Definitely saw a bunch of kids. So it was definitely a totally different, you might even say a more typical Dynamite crowd. So.
Yeah, interesting. So without the benefit of that kind of international cosmopolitan Toronto audience for a big pay-per-view, how did the fans react to Moxley and Ishii, for example? Were fans super into it, or did they seem stunned by what they were watching, or what?
It was okay. I mean, it wasn't anything like Toronto, but it was fine. They were just happy to see Mox and Eddie Kingston got an okay pop.
Do you have, going back to the Dark Order Elite match, any other observations in terms of the dynamic there? Did you think the reactions would have been different for the two teams that they worked against each other? Because it is just by definition kind of awkward because they're two teams that technically are basically.
That didn't help, but I didn't really get the impression that anyone really knew Evil Uno was Canadian. It didn't seem, they were just cheered because they were, you know, they're the Dark Order and they're goofballs, but no, I think it really seemed like a definite negative reaction to the Elite, which I was quite shocked by.
Interesting, yeah. How about Jungle Boy Jack Perry's promo? What kind of heat did he get? That's kind of the area where I wasn't sure, because of the crowd size in the arena and the way the mics picked up the crowd, how strong of a negative reaction he was getting.
I actually thought it was a pretty good negative reaction, but you're saying it didn't really come up on television.
It seemed negative, but it like I said, it came across like a less full building, but there was there was certainly strong booing, but I couldn't tell if the crowd was sort of like, you want us to boo you, but we're not going to give you that until you prove to us you deserve that kind of energy from us. But you were in the building, so you may have a little
bit. Yeah. Any sort of muted reaction seemed more like just like they didn't really know what was going on or they didn't care that much. I don't think it was anything like he had to earn it or anything. It was just a sort of a pretty good heel heat, but nothing off the chart.
Yeah. What did you think of the promo, by the way? How did it play live?
I thought it was good. I mean, usually I cringe when Perry takes the mic, but it actually seemed pretty good. Maybe that was a live thing. I'm not sure, but.
I thought it was pretty good, too.
It was decent.
Yeah. Yeah, decent, pretty good, something to build on, not polished yet, but you wouldn't expect that. Eric, do you want to jump in with a question?
Chris, do you plan to go tomorrow night back to Hamilton when they tape Collision for Saturday tape daring?
No, sadly we're tapping out at three shows in five nights.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot. I'm going to have the same problem in Chicago in late August, early September when they do three shows. In the market, boy, if you thought tonight did the building sound full tonight? I think they've only got 2,000 tickets sold for tomorrow night's Collision taping. So they're gonna. I mean, as somebody who recently attended a Rampage taping after Dynamite last week and then watched Rampage back, they can definitely do things with the sound and did last week during that. Johnny TV, Johnny Morrison debut segment. It was go away heat in the building. It didn't come across that way on TV. So AEW can cover up for the fact that there's not going to be a ton of people there. And I take it, Chris, you judging that you're in your car, you did not stay for tonight's Rampage taping.
No, there wasn't anything that great on there. So we just decided we'll call it a week.
It is a school night, yep.
And if you blinked, you missed the hype for Collision. MJF wrestling on Collision is a draw, but it wasn't exactly a big focus of Dynamite. So I'm a little nervous about that viewership that already dropped under 600,000. This isn't good timing to have a kind of an off-week lineup-wise. Chris, a pretty traditional question. Who got the biggest crowd reactions of the night?
I think Eddie Kingston definitely got a pop when he came out. Who else did you say? Just asking my wife.
Both got a big pop.
Just an in-house note. There was a dark match, Ethan Page versus Preston Vance. Local boy from Hamilton, Ethan Page. He got a pretty good pop, obviously.
Did they put him over in his hometown?
Yeah.
Near his hometown?
Yeah. They put him over in a dark match. I'm going to say the biggest pop was after Dynamite went off the air, Sting and Darby did a promo. By the way, I can confirm I have a medical update. Sting did say he had some loose teeth and will need some stitches.
Oh, boy. All right. Well, that fit his response, which was checking his mouth right away after that landing. So good medical update. But I'm glad he can speak and hopefully in good spirits about landing on Clara's knee. Not what he was
hoping
for.
Now that I think of it, definitely Sting after the match in the dark promo, definitely biggest pop.
The MJF Adam Cole stuff happened on, I assume, on the big screen, and you got to see it. Was the crowd, you know, laughing along, enthralled, entertained, or distracted and getting up to go to the concourse?
That's when I kind of noticed it. In Toronto, you put anyone up on the screen, there's a reaction. Anyone up on the screen here, no one's really even paying attention. There was this arena, it doesn't have like a big jumbotron in the center.
Okay.
So yeah. It felt very intimate, very small, and all they had was the one screen on the Dynamite set. So most backstage stuff was just sort of there, and it wasn't really getting reactions at all.
What was the low point of the show? Did any part drag or lose the crowd?
I hate to say it, but, you know, the 9:30 curse, the female 9:30 match, Ruby Riott, that's when, you know, no one stood. People went to the bathroom, but that's pretty much part of the course the way AEW has been booking the women.
Yes, for sure, especially with Baker being advertised and it's a local jobber instead. Takes the wind out of the sails a little bit. Eric, anything else you want to ask our correspondent?
I do not.
Chris, anything else you want to add from your experience at the show tonight?
Actually, my wife, Katie, would like to talk to you. Is that okay?
We'd love
also
that.
Also in the car?
Yes, of course. Yes.
Hi, how are you guys? Sorry, I'm driving, so I'm not holding the phone. My husband is. First things first, I want to clarify, we are not Team Punk. We are Team Elite, Team Kenny, 100%. And I actually had the chance to sit row one at Forbidden Door on the floor. And
oh, wow.
It was absolutely electric. It was so amazing and just such a different crowd. Compared to tonight, tonight was a good show, but I just think you can't compare the card from Sunday to tonight at all, obviously, right? So, but it was great.
Definitely not. That's why this was free and you had to pay $60 to see that Sunday show. By the way, sit in the front row. I don't know if you can get a sense of the whole arena, but by the main event, were you exhausted? Or with Okada Danielson, kind of the conventional analysis and observations from watching from afar through the screen is the crowd was burned out during that match at times. What did you read as far as crowd energy level by that point?
Down on the floor, we were into it for the full 5 hours, basically standing, but it's hard not to be when you're so close to the action. Okada Danielson match, it really didn't live up to expectations. I wouldn't say it was because the crowd was low energy. Everybody was still really into it. But I think, you know, once Danielson obviously got injured and Okada seemed pretty gassed as well, to be honest, he was resting a lot in front of us and I don't know, the pace of the match and the ending was really disappointing. You can definitely tell everybody at the end was kind of deflated, that's how they're ending Forbidden Door. I understand circumstances, you know, with Danielson's injury, but I don't think anything after Omega Ospreay could even touch it, you know, the energy. So, yeah.
Yeah. What was the highlight for you Sunday night?
Oh, I'm a huge Kenny Omega fan, so Omega Ospreay, just totally blew my mind.
Yeah, it's hard for that not to be the highlight unless you just happen to have another, you know, favorite who just had a good match or you've never seen live, because that was, jumped off the screen as an amazing, amazing match.
For sure. I think seeing Okada wrestle was definitely a highlight for me. Naito was amazing. Honestly, the card was just stacked right from the beginning, so it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and I'm just so, so lucky. I actually got to be on the screen during Judas, so that was also like a lifetime achievement.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
We'll replay it
so
up for
you.
Cool. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, it was great.
So anything else you want to share from? Yeah, go ahead.
Wait,
yeah,
Chris again. I just wanted to mention, if you're ever watching the Omega match, when Omega put his foot on the rope, do you remember when Omega put his foot on the rope and Don Callis is right there? She's actually in the shot, and Don Callis is making one face, and she's making a complete other face. That's just hilarious. I'll send you the picture.
Oh, awesome.
It's like a, it's like a meme. It's like a meme. He's like disgusted, and she's thrilled, and they're both in the same shot. It's really funny.
Oh, that's awesome. That's so cool. Man, front row for that show. That is, it's going to be hard to top that as a wrestling fan.
All right, well, we're just passing the Rogers Center. Go Jays, go. We'll let you go and get to other callers.
Great. Thanks, Chris. Thanks, Kate. Katie, good to hear from you guys. Call again.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Cool. Appreciate that. If you want to be an on-site correspondent for us, you can cold call us like they did. It's even better if you let us know ahead of time, just so we kind of look for your number and know your and make sure we fit you in on time, especially because sometimes your time is limited, especially if you're still at the arena trying to sneak in a call like Eric. Drop us a line, WadeKellerPodcast@pwtorch.com. WadeKellerPodcast@pwtorch.com. And put the name of the city in the subject line, at least. That helps me stay organized and get back to you and find you when the date is approaching. All right. Our number, if you are still live streaming us and want to participate, 347-215-8558. That's 347-215-8558. When you call push 1, you can also email us at WadeKellerPodcast@pwtorch.com. We'll get to emails in a little bit, but first up is Derek in Utah. Derek, thanks for holding. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind about tonight's show?
I just want to sound off on the Jungle Boy promo. I'd have to agree with Eric. I'd rate it about a 6. And I think what holds him back is, to me, it seems like a cosplay heel wrestler. I mean, even with the attire.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Yep.
Even with the attire, the leather jacket, and the sun dark shades, and then even the way it almost comes straight from like a casting call when you're going to hit your point and you pull down your glasses. There's guys who can do that. There's guys who can do that in an authentic manner when it seems like they're trying to focus in and really hit the exclamation point at the end of a sentence. But when he did it, it was just like, okay, he obviously planned that when he says this line, he's going to pull down his glasses. And so to me, it just comes across as someone who's trying to be a heel wrestler for Halloween and has memorized a few mannerisms that he's seen over the past 30 years, rather than someone who's really trying to authentically speak or portray a villain, is what I saw with that. But
now, to me, Derek, a six is a mild thumbs up, and you just trashed it. So are you standing by your 6, or what positives did you see in it that you'd give it above a 5?
So here's one positive, and it sounds small, but to me it means a lot, is there is bass in his voice. And I think, like, when someone talks and they don't have bass in their voice, it doesn't matter how nasty or what they say, it comes across. Even MJF, I'll say this about MJF, I know people love when he talks, but for me it took me a long time to take anything he said seriously because it came across like a comedian, not like someone who was trying to verbally eviscerate somebody, you know? And so I think Jungle Boy's voice has the potential to be threatening and smarmy at the same time. And so that elevates it a lot for me, to be honest. Sounds simple, but I think it means a lot. Damian Priest doesn't have to say much. His voice is so low that it seems threatening.
And then there's Dolph Ziggler.
Perfect counter there.
Yeah.
But I think the key to Jungle Boy getting over as a heel, especially as a smaller heel, and I think this is where most of the heels in AEW, WWE, last 20 years have come up short, is whether they're supposed to be a chicken heel is a smaller guy or even a guy who's bigger but still plays the chicken role, is they just don't have that nasty mean streak when it counts. And I think if Jungle Boy could develop that mean streak, and I have always liked a heel who acts like the toughest guy in the room until he gets put in his place, and then he cowers, but then once he gets the advantage, he's just nasty and he's mean. And I think no matter your size, any wrestler can do that. They just have to have the aggressiveness to get the point over. And if he doesn't have that, I think he'll be a Sammy Guevara Hill who's still hitting pretty moves, limiting his potential to actually be a main event player. So your thoughts on that?
Yeah, in your initial description of the interview, sort of cosplay and the thing about lowering the sunglasses at the planned spot and it not looking natural is kind of what I was trying to get at when I talked about him portraying a heel in the ring. And I think we're going to get that early. I do think it's going to feel like too thought out and, oh, this is when I do this and this is how I turn and this is the posture a heel makes when he yells at the fans. But I still think, and that's why you didn't give it a 1 or 2 out of 10, or 3 out of 10, there's something there that was there as a baby face that was sort of off-putting mixed with the things that you liked about him and were rooting for him. But there are some things that would leak out and, you know, the unintended. And if he can build on that, yeah, this it doesn't feel like a lost cause. But I'm sure he'd admit he's a work in progress. But the key is there's heels who can help, and there's – you know, just get reps in, just get reps in. And if he's a little clunky, you know, but not awful, I don't think fans are going to just, like, do go-away heat or stop reacting to him. I think there's potential, not to be Dominic, although that's a good role model at this point for a heel, although he's a very different character than Jungle Boy. But, you know, you can surprise people by really getting yourself over if you just find that sweet spot in terms of your demeanor and how you react to things. Eric, any additional thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think – I don't want to say it's sink or swim for Jungle Boy because he's gotten and will get lots of chances as a homegrown AEW original. But, you know, at some point you do have to actually produce at that next level to be a top star, right? And that hasn't happened yet outside of the in-ring, right? He's a good worker as a babyface in the ring. There's raw material there to work with, though, right? He can have his long hair back in a ponytail, which is always kind of a shorthand in Hollywood for douchebag, right? He can be real cocky. He's naturally cocky, I get the sense. And he can talk about how he gets the best-looking women, you know. I mean, there are things you can do that he has in his favor, kind of like if you watch the old HBO show Entourage. The lead character, Vinny Chase, was the babyface, but he was also kind of a douchebag to your average guy. And, you know, you can get over, you could do the Rick Rude stuff. Look how good-looking I am. I get the best-looking women, and you guys are a bunch of fat Midwestern slops. I mean, maybe that veers into the old-timey heel shtick that Wade wants him to avoid. But it's not like there's not raw material. He just needs the reps to – he's either going to polish it and kill it, or he won't. And AEW will finally know, you know, do they have something with this guy or do they not, maybe? And I don't know how long they give him before, you know, waiting to see results.
All right, very good. Anything else, Derek?
Just one follow-up is I've been waiting for this for years, and it's a challenge to Jungle Boy, and that is I'd really like to see predominantly high-spot wrestler who goes heel eliminate every fancy move from his arsenal. Because I think by doing that, you're forcing yourself to wrestle in a different manner that does not elicit crowd cheers. And I think most guys, they still are kind of stuck in that, well, I got to hit this because, you know, the crowd pops when I do this, or I still want to do this. And, you know, and that's their fallback because they don't have the confidence in their character. But once that's your safety net, my challenge to everybody would always be take away the safety net and let's see what you can actually do. Because without the safety net, if you can get over with punch kick, dirty tactic, mean streak, that's what's going to make you a top-tier player. Not, oh, man, the crowd's silent, so I better do a flip. You know, because I think that's where a lot of guys, that's their mentality is, man, I'm afraid of the silence. Sometimes the silence is what makes it. So when the babyface fires up, they actually get a response where people are getting behind them, not chanting, this is awesome, because they've seen a few cool moves, because that's overdone now, not special anymore. You know, and so that would be my challenge to Jungle Boy. And one more thing, if you got time for me, and I'll just ask the question and then let you guys answer and sign off. And that is, I think when I think of what AEW desperately needs, which they failed to develop, is who's the top babyface? And they've tried guys. We saw Silky Adam. I just forgot his name, Adam Page. We saw Silky Adam Page today, which was disappointing. And Adam Cole, for whatever reason, is not resonating. So in your guys' opinion, who's the top-level babyface that we should get behind in AEW? Who's their top guy? And I'll let you guys answer that, and I appreciate you guys taking
Thanks, Derek. Yeah, I mean, it's certainly at times been a concern, if not a criticism, of AEW. They have people who could have been. CM Punk's getting booed by a portion of the audience. Danielson and Moxley are kind of wedged into a heel gimmick that people don't necessarily want to boo. Hangman Page is now going against Dark Order, and Dark Order is saying, you weren't a good friend. And Page is firing back, why not your babysitter? I think, you know, obviously Hangman and the Bucks and Kenny are meant to be baby faces. Kenny might be a candidate for top baby face. Adam Cole, CM Punk might have more cheers than anyone, even if there are more boos than anyone too coming his way. What do you think, Eric?
I mean, the top guy is Punk, right? And the problem is also, as you note, for him to be the top babyface, they'd have to run every week in Chicago, and you'd burn out the city eventually by running every week with every week in Chicago. I do wonder, because they've been, you know, in theory could have been Cody, except Cody from Jump Street boxed himself out of the title picture. You know, with the Jericho stipulation at Full Gear 2019, and then, you know, just did a lot of bad stuff that got him booed, and he had to leave the company as a result. It got a big money offer from WWE. He's doing well there, with more editing. So, you know, it seems to me that it's Punk, and they're relying on Punk to draw ratings and sell tickets on Saturday night. He's going to get booed. So who's the other person who could be the top babyface? I mean, it's MJF. MJF was getting cheered when he came back last September at All Out, cheered in Punk's hometown after Punk just won the title, right? Crowd goes nuts. And then they had to spend weeks with Punk doing lowest common denominator heel promos to get the fans against MJF again, right, to make him a heel again. He just had to be completely despicable. But if they need a babyface, to me, he's the eventual MJF babyface turn, assuming he's, you know, re-signed and his contract is not up at the end of the year, which he has not been talking about as much lately. And I've long thought that Tony Khan would be a fool if he gave the guy the big push and didn't have him signed beyond this year. So, those would be my two top candidates. Anybody else we're missing? I don't think so.
On the babyface women's division side, who jumps out?
Willow Nightingale is somebody the fans like. I don't know that I think of her as ready to carry the division.
No.
Jamie Hayter was injured, but I think her coming back and in London, if she's back from her shoulder injury by then, and she wins the belt, that'll be a huge, huge pop. I think she's from Southampton, England, which is in the southern part of England, but would be cheered as a home country babyface hero if she comes back, and that's where she faces Toni Storm. And, you know, Britt Baker – she hasn't had the – she had the babyface run, but her run on top was as a heel, right? Her run with the belt was as a heel. She also, I guess, has the potential to be built back up and to carry. But those would be the two that jump out at me. But, you know, the AEW as a promotion does not book their women in a position to be, you know, money-drawing stars like a Becky Lynch in WWE, for example.
Yeah, yeah. All right, very good. Thanks, Derek, for the call. We'll go to LaMarcus in D.C. next. LaMarcus, welcome. What's on your mind about Dynamite tonight?
Anyway, hey, Eric. Hey, guys.
Hey.
Can you hear me? Okay. I thought that was a good show. Only what you mentioned earlier about Renee, I do think there was a segment or two with her and John before, and this probably was during the Hangman Page feud, but I do believe I think one you mentioned earlier, you know, like, yeah, I do believe I've seen that before also. And I thought that it was funny when they sort of led into that segment, I guess it was Excalibur, he was saying, he was like going from the previous segment to that backstage that he said, Renee Paquette remains on the job. Let's go back to Renee. And then the first thing he says is, John, what the hell is going on with you? And I just bust out laughing because this is like he's still working, but like she didn't have a mic in her hand or anything. But I just thought that was very funny. But even with the whole Eddie and Moxley, I do feel like I missed maybe a segment or two with this story. But I just thought that was funny. Also, I think the Chris from Oklahoma, I also thought that MJF and Adam Cole's shirt was cool. I did get a chuckle out of that also. I want to say with Jungle Boy, I feel like I'm understanding the character. I do see the potential in it. And I, even with the segment, I just thought, no, it's a start, but I do see the potential in it. And I kind of like that he called Hook up and titled Second Generation Prick. And even with Jungle Boy, Captain America's got saying that he needs to find his character and whatever, but I do feel like I see a lot of the Christian influence in him. And even that calling him a second generation prick, I feel like there's kind of like a Christian influence. And I can imagine, if they'll feel sort of connected, they'll show a Christian backstage or smirking at the monitor while watching Jungle Boy do the promo. And also when they were doing the Four Pillars segment, Four Pillars feud, I think Christian said that Jungle Boy has a lot of potential or something like that. And just need to get his head out of his ass. he'll be destined for greatness kind of thing. So I do feel like, in a way, this is kind of the Christian influence. And I feel like they haven't talked about this or anything, but I would like to imagine that the Luchasaurus TNT title win sort of was a trigger because he's kind of seeing from a distance that what Christian did for Luchasaurus, and he's kind of missing out on it. Not saying that he, like, Mrs. Christian, but he's probably thinking this is like, no, Christian is right, was right. He was trying to turn Jungle Boy heel and everything. And so I just want to know what you guys think about that.
Eric, as LaMarcus was talking, I'm thinking, is a reunion with Christian and Jungle Boy on coming up after Hook, after the Hook feud, and maybe Luchasaurus turns babyface, seeing a Jungle Boy with Christian as heels against Luchasaurus?
Sort of feels like Jungle Boy would be spinning his wheels if they did that. So the temptation would be to stick Jungle Boy with a heel manager who could be a mouthpiece for him because promos aren't his strength. But I think that defeats the purpose. You know, you got to get the guy reps. He's either going to succeed or he's going to fail, and you won't know until you try. And so, you know, they put him with – he didn't speak for the longest time, right? He was a character who did not speak, not unlike Hook, for the longest time. And then Christian was the mouthpiece. And slowly but surely over the last year, Jungle Boy has been, you know, getting pre-tape time and a little bit of live mic time. And tonight was a lot of live mic time. So, you got to try. So, you know, sticking in with Don Callis would be, I think someone maybe on the Torch post show raised that idea. So I heard it somewhere this week, not my thought, but that would be a temptation, you know, with Takeshita joining him in a stable that Don Callis is building a family to take on the elite. I don't know. I don't think you'd do that because then he's not going to grow. So let him stand on his own. I see the temptation, though, to go back with Christian.
All right, LaMarcus, anything else quick you want to chime in with?
Yeah, I would say to say that they should get back. Yeah, I don't think they should. I guess with me, sometimes I watch wrestling, I sort of try to process the why, sort of like why Jungle Boy's turning. And I know he did blame the fans and everything, but I just sort of, you know, if Tony Khan is sort of trying to get to the sort of like storyline, Jungle Boy's heel turn could be kind of be explained from his dealings with Christian, because he could, I just feel like, you know, in some way, like Christian, the, you know, the Christian feud and everything kind of changed him. So that's probably part of the reason why he sort of, you know, turning him about, I could see kind of like the Christianism or whatever. That he's trying to pull off and everything.
Yeah, they certainly, to your point, LaMarcus, during his feud with Christian, the thing was, do you have the guts to use the chair? And he finally did, right? He finally hit him with the concerto to win that casket match. And then last month, what he had in May, when he had the world title match, he could have won if he used the belt, but he couldn't do it, right? But Jungle Boy didn't use the belt to win the belt. So I think you raise good points.
LaMarcus, anything else?
Yeah. Also, I think Sting needs an intervention, because the caller earlier said that, you know, he watched it like with anger. And I watched it when I saw what it was happening. I muted the TV and I like looked away because I'm just looking at like the ladder too far away from the rope. And I mean, I think what you mentioned earlier, Sting was known for his like jumps and stuff. And that's something I don't really know because I didn't really watch WCW, and the stuff I do remember from Sting is just, you know, coming from the Raptors and stuff. So even with the Stinger Splash, I guess that makes sense why he does Stinger Splash. But even when I see that, he doesn't really get a lot of hype. But even just watching in real time, I was like, I don't understand why he was doing it and stuff. But yeah, that was unnecessary. But I had to look away from that. But yeah, look like he did like make.
Yeah.
Mess up. We're not, you know, hurt his chin and stuff. And Dark Order. I hope they are. I'm assuming they're not trying to be portrayed as heels. And but also with them, like as far as their character, I guess it kind of makes sense because since Brody's death, they're sort of looking for a leader. And I guess they're so desperate to find a leader that they may hang in their leader in a way, or someone that they're looking up to, and with him turning his back on them, quote unquote, it's sort of making them kind of go, I guess, obsessive or possessive with him and kind of feud with him. My question with that, do you think that's a way they're trying to portray Dark Order with Heyman? Because other than that, if that's not the case, then they just come off as annoying. Like, I kind of roll my eyes when they show up on the screen with Heyman.
There has been backstory laid down for this for weeks. Unfortunately, the only place you could see it was on Being the Elite, that YouTube show that gets, I don't know, 100 to 150,000 viewers a week. So,
Collision's third episode viewership number, I am told.
Wade. Although CM Punk is not advertised for this week's Collision.
I know.
I don't think in any way, shape, or form. So
yep.
That should be interesting. Yeah, you would have. So there's a couple things going on. One, there's, you know, the Dark Order have been complaining for weeks on BTE, months even, off and on about Hangman not returning their texts, their calls. And then I think on Ring of Honor, if I'm recalling it correctly, Stu Grayson has turned heel and joined Dutch and Vinny. in their heel group name is escaping me, and they are feuding with the Dark Order, and they keep taunting the Dark Order to be more aggressive and heelish. Now, again, if you thought that the 120,000 people who watch BTE knew about that, what is it, 15,000 was the last number Tony Khan gave for Ring of Honor Honor Club viewership. Yeah. So even a more minuscule slice of the audience has seen that or knows any of that. But that's just trying to fill in a little bit of the gaps on what's going on there.
I'm glad you are. Is this Hangman in good hands right now? Is this on a good trajectory for you, or would you tweak things or overhaul things with him in Dark Order right now?
Well, I assume this was just a one-off because to fill TV time, and that, you know, Hangman's in a good place right now on balance because he was feuding with Jon Moxley for many months, and he won that feud, or, you know, he won the last match, and then they segued right into the Elite versus BCC feud and the Elite reunited. So –
They did another angle, though, in the last few weeks with Hangman and Dark Order. I mean, it wasn't just a one-off in that it came out of nowhere. There was something, I'm trying to recall the details, where Dark Order was set. So, yeah.
It makes me think
they're going to do more. Like, this, you know, that this is going to lead to a Dark Order heel turn, and then Hangman, after, you know, Blood and Guts or something.
Well, that wouldn't be good. I mean,
I know. Well, that's my concern. Yeah.
I assume they're blowing off this feud at Blood and Guts on July 19th. So,
yeah.
What is that? 3 Dynamites from now, maybe. So we'll get some sort of resolution there, I would think, because they've done a bunch of matches. They did the Anarchy in the Arena, and Blood and Guts is their blow off. So,
yeah.
I don't know what's up for the Bucks or Hangman Page after that.
Yeah. All right. Very good. Appreciate it, LaMarcus. Any quick closing words? I want to get to another call here before we get to mailbag.
Yep. This is one, I guess, random question. As far as collision go, with CM Punk, the face of collision, I find it interesting. I'm not sure if it shows on Gas TV, but, like, you know, if you record something, it shows, like, the – just say the poster of the show. And for my CM Punk isn't even on the poster. The two center people are MJF and Orange Cassidy. I'm not sure. That's been the case since day one collision. And I was wondering if you think that's because of, you know, the kind of uncertainty of CM Punk coming back, and they already had the show sort of in the pipeline, or it's just more of a coincidence. Yes,
I didn't understand. I'm sorry, Eric. Did you understand the question?
When you DVR a show, when you record a show, there's artwork that comes up with it, right?
Yeah.
And it's AEW Collision logo, and it doesn't have CM Punk on it. Is that right, LaMarcus? Is that what you said?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not a wrestling sign.
Yeah,
it's not CM Punk.
So. I would guess your instincts are correct that there was that little week of a blip where CM Punk was pulled from the announcement of the show, pulled from the press release. Well, he was pulled from most of the press releases. One of them did make the internet until they yanked down the link. And that's why. And I think they just haven't gotten to it. I think it's possible on my DVR. I have Xfinity Comcast. I think it's possible during the whole time Punk was gone that he was still on my Dynamite logo that I got with my DVR.
Those logos are notoriously delayed. I think John Cena is like still on my like SmackDown or Raw graphic, and Cody's still there on my AEW graphic. I'm making that up, but there's something equivalent to that where it's like, come on, update this. It's time, but.
Yeah, Sasha's on SmackDown
right,
for
cool.
me. But thanks for taking my call.
Cool, great. Good talking to you, LaMarcus. But they should update that, though. I mean, that should be something they do. I don't know how much of a difference it would make, but, you know, I would be doing all the little things to try to make Collision a success. And throwing in the towel in week 3 is not a good idea at all. And, I mean, MJF appearing, you know, MJF would be insulted saying, you're throwing in the towel, I'm on the show. But it was not a show that was built around trying to get people who tuned out after the week 1 to tune in on week 3. And why not Why not try harder? I mean, why not do something? Yeah.
It is. Punk has some outside acting engagements. It's possible some of that's involved, right?
So, yeah, so two thoughts. One, I'm not even specifically talking about Punk. I'm like, just give us more than Excalibur running through the lineup. So find a way to make up for that. And I think they think, well, MJFing on the show is making up for it. We'll make a bigger deal out of that. And number two, you could, I don't know if it's advisable to play this card, but you could do a sit-down interview with Punk that you recorded on Sunday talking about the Owen Hart tournament, but don't say that's what it's about, and say we got a sit-down interview with Punk, and you just talk about his opponents in the Owen Hart tournament and maybe drop a seat or two about his aspirations and, you know, kind of a fluff piece, but at least it's a little more of a personality profile where you can show a little more about what his current character is and what he's going for. And again, it's a way to not lose momentum on week three by saying, hey, he's not going to be wrestling every week, but it is the CM Punk show. He's a collision guy. We're going to find a way to get him on TV in something that should be intriguing and newsworthy every week for a while.
And they may have done that. And if they did, and hopefully they did, they didn't promote it tonight, right? And
right, that's even
promote it in front of their biggest audience, right? Instead of hoping that Thursday or Friday, when people are gearing up for the weekend or gearing up to watch SmackDown or going on summer vacation, that they might see of something on social media or on one of the wrestling sites that's going to write a headline off of that. Punk to appear in interview, right? You'd want to do it with your biggest weekly audience, I think, promote that Punk's going to be there if you had something like that.
Yeah. Yep. All right, Brian, back to you.
Oh, I don't think you guys went to me before.
Oh my God, I did just think I said goodbye to Marcus and then I didn't. Thank you. Let's just you know, redo this.
Mark for edit.
Brian from Boston, you're up next. How's it going? What's on your mind about Dynamite?
That's all right. I kind of know how John Moxley feels cutting himself all the time because I John Moxley myself trying to assemble something together today, which makes me think, why does he do that all the time? Just use blood capsules or something. You get the effect without the damage. I mean, jeez.
Was it a screwdriver that you busted yourself open with?
No, I was trying to assemble like a piece of furniture thing, and I was trying to pull it out and smack me right in the head. So, yeah.
My son today came into the office and said, "Where's the box cutter?" And I'm like, "No." And he goes, "Oh, I use box cutters all the time." And I'm like, "What?"
Yeah. Is it just me, or did the show seem less helter-skelter tonight? It seemed like it was slower paced and things had more of a chance to breathe, and I think as a result of that, they kind of went over the two-hour window, and that's fine, but you can't just end the main event like literally like moments after the match ends. I mean, you got to make it seem significant. It didn't really seem significant, and that kind of leads into my larger point about the main event. Why is Chris Jericho losing again? I mean, if you're trying to build up Sting versus Jericho as a one-on-one match at Wembley, which is a possibility. I'm not sure if they're doing a tag or something like that, but it sure seems like they're building up to a singles at Wembley. Why would you have Sting tap him out to the sharpshooter instead of having either Sammy or Darby Allin take the losing fall? Because Jericho, I mean, I know Jericho's older now and he's at the giving back and putting things over things, but it doesn't change the fact that he's lost twice in a row to Ricky Starks, twice in a row to Adam Cole, and now he's lost this thing in a tag match, which really should have been built up a lot more than it was. I mean, it was a good main event, but it just kind of felt, I don't know, empty. I mean, you can't, if you're going to build up a big match like that, especially in front of a 70,000 plus crowd by the time they get to Wembley, that didn't seem like the best way to do it.
Eric, is Jericho losing and expecting praise as opposed to criticism for a guy 52-53, quote, giving back? Although if you're giving back to a guy who's 64, that's a little different. But it also was a nice gesture. is this, you know, Jericho kind of signaling to people, this is the stage I'm at, and I'm okay with it?
I wouldn't, given the backstage machinations that Chris Jericho has proven himself capable of over the years, including AEW, I would be surprised if that were the case. I, too, am puzzled for why he's been eating all these losses lately. I don't really have an answer for it. I don't think the answer is a singles match in front of 70,000 or more people by the time all is said and done in London with Sting, because Sting, I don't think he has he even had a singles match since he's been in AEW. I think they've all been tags with Darby, if I'm not mistaken. There, at most, there was one or two, but I think they've all been tag matches for good reason. I barely want to see Chris Jericho in a singles match after his miserable performance against Adam Cole. That match just at Double or Nothing just was roundly criticized and just a surprise underperformer. So the two of them together, oof, man, it would have to be a walk-in brawl around the arena, and I still think they would get blown up in it, and I'm not sure you want to put Sting in that position, or Jericho for that matter. I don't have a good answer for your question, Brian.
I don't think the losses, Eric, are bad as much as it would be good to sprinkle in a win here and there. You know, just find somebody that Jericho can pick on and beat up. So beating him seems like you're accomplishing something in 2023. I think that's something you could do. Bryant, back to you.
Yeah, I'm, you know, this thing about backstage politicking that you bring up, I would be willing to bet a certain amount of money that the person that was reported as being pissed off after last week's Dynamite show and saying basically dissing CM Punk, I'd be willing to bet that was probably Jericho. That's just what my instinct is, because that has his hallmarks backstage politicking all over it. But never mind the fact that never should have been a news story, especially when you're trying to do that, and I don't know. I just think things like that shouldn't be leaked out or whatever. But anyway, moving on. I'm convinced more than ever. I mean, Ruby Soho cut a really good promo, and it made me want to see the Britt Baker match more. But the more I see the women's division, the more I think Tony Khan, it's clear he's not prioritizing it like he should be, but I don't think that's as much his intention. I think he cares. I just think he's got way too much things on his plate, and he isn't focusing on it like he should be. So maybe he should. And I think if he can shelve off the booking duties to someone who, you know, actually has the time and the dedication to put some effort into it, not Kenny Omega, because we've seen how bad of a mistake that's been. But, you know, I really think, and I know AEW having too many women's titles, having too many titles, period, but I think if you get rid, I think if you just unify the TBS and the women's titles, just have one singles title, that way you get rid of one, I think, you know, you have a decent amount of women on the roster in two shows. I mean, there should be more than one women's match on a show. And I think if you just have if you're serious about building it up, and, you know, if you want to get people to care and invest in storylines and stuff, I think introducing tag titles, you know, once everything, you know, once you've built up, you know, teams and stuff, the obvious qualifiers, not something you should rush pell-mell into. I think that would be a good idea, you know, because it would give more of the women something to do instead of, you know, just having your one throwaway match away. Just, I don't know, just something to consider.
So I don't think, I don't think introducing new titles is the answer to anything in AEW, but if it, I think there's other avenues to doing a better job making people care about the women's division, but it is an area that is not. It is not a priority for Tony. It's not a passion of his. We know where his passions lie, and women's wrestling isn't one of them. And having somebody else where that is their passion, but they also are really competent at, you know, pushing for time and promoting and helping produce some of the women who don't know how to present themselves as stars and are doing some, you know, more indie-rific stuff, would be helpful. I mean, that's a broad question that continues to be brought up, and I'm not seeing a ton of progress, but, you know, I thought Willa Nightingale had a breakout moment on Sunday. And I don't know that they, you know, I don't know. We'll see if they follow up on that. But you got to get behind somebody besides, you know, Britt Baker and the Outcasts, and really get behind them and treat them like a star. And it just, that takes some of Tony's attention. That's obviously divided in a lot of different places there.
Yeah, I mean, AEW finally seemed to be getting enough good women's workers to sort of justify giving more time to the women's matches. You know, they've got Toni Storm, really good worker. I think Ruby Soho's, you know, has a lot of positives. You have Statlander, who seems to be over with the fans. Britt Baker, Jamie Hayter, and Riho, and Shida, Hikaru Shida. So, I mean, those are seven
Riho.
Women's wrestlers, right? What's that?
Please not Riho.
Riho is... She's over with the crowd. It gets over in every match. I get that there's a believability issue with her, but, you know, in terms of a nucleus you could build around and have more than one feud at a time, you know, mix and match those women. And it just has never seemed to take place. And we're, what, 4+ years into the promotion. So I don't know. I don't know when that's going to take place. Did I include Britt in that list? Jamie Hayter? I don't know if I did. But, you know, the point is there's enough women to have more than, you know, to your point, one feud at a time. And they're not doing that. And I'm guessing it's because the ratings generally don't show that it's a winning strategy for them. And they analyze the minute by minutes every week. And okay. I do not know what the answer is for why AEW falls off a cliff after 9:15 Eastern, 8:15 Central every week. But those last three quarters just go down, down, down. And I'm not sure if that's competition or lack of interest or what.
Well, they don't do a good job promoting their main events. You got Sting and Jericho. I mean, every week there's the best grade you can probably ever give them in hyping their main events is like a B-. And most of the time it's a D+, C-. I mean, they just act like people who tune in are going to stay tuned in. And once the main event comes around, sometimes you're like, oh, that's right, that's the main event. I haven't thought about that since the last time they mentioned it, an hour and 20 minutes ago. So they could be better about that and make that at this point. You also have the self-fulfilling prophecy of putting the women in a spot where they look like they're ratings losers, but you haven't done enough to, over time, not just in a, you know, right before a test, the night before a test, you don't crash, you binge. No, not binge. What's the word I'm looking for? The night before a test, Eric, you...
Cram.
Cram, thank you, yes. Cram for a test. You don't
never
cram...
Works.
Yeah, well, I wanted to find the word I couldn't find. You don't cram at the last second and try to make people care. You got to spend months doing it and you know, find out who you believe in and treat them like they're a big deal and not just inherit their star power when you get them and just have them stay in that spot perpetually. So it's a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy in both respects, women's being a drop-off and then the main event not being as much of a draw as it should be with some of the stuff they put in that final spot. Brian, anything else quick you want to jump in with? I want to get to Evel and I got to run soon.
Yeah. It's been five, and he's got 5 hours of television. There's really no excuse why it's not better building up the women's divisions. But I'll just end on a note. I thought MJF's promo work was brilliant. I mean, when he's not busy hamming it up with stupid musicals or things like that, he's just playing a completely fake, nice guy, getting along and yet still throwing in his barbs at the same time. I thought he was great, kind of cozying up to Adam Cole a little bit. So I just like the work he's doing, and that storyline is going pretty well. So that's just what I'll end with. And thanks for taking the call, and you guys have a good night.
Excellent. Thanks, Brian. Good to talk to you. All right, we'll get to the email portion of the show here, and we will begin with Zach in Texas, who says there's a lot I could say about tonight's show. But first, we all need to rise from our chairs and give Sting a standing ovation. He took a flying leap off a ladder, probably lost a tooth in the process, got up and finished the match by tapping out Jericho with the Scorpion Deathlock, all at age 64. When he climbed that ladder, I didn't know whether to be scared or stunned. He is one crazy SOB, but you have to respect him. I'm in awe of what he's willing to put his body through at his age. He intends to make this a very memorable final year of his life. How dumb was Jericho to get into a bat war with Sting? We all know Sting's bat breaks sledgehammers. It's like getting into a hammer fight with Thor. You don't stand a chance. I could talk about Jack Perry slipping nicely into his heel roll or Mox and Ishii beating the hell out of each other, but I'm just in awe of the Stinger right now. So, yeah, I mean, I don't want to take away, even though I would not do it and I would advise against it, he did it. And he is willing to sacrifice or take chances and, you know, go above and beyond what he has to do to earn his paycheck. And in that sense, I wish it was made more clear. Maybe they try that you don't need to do this to earn your keep. But I understand what Zach's getting to. I mean, Sting could have stayed down and, you know, he did get up and finish the match and did so well. So, I mean, it, you know, just the fact that we don't want to see it happen. I don't think it was a craziest spot he's ever done. But I still stand by. Let's tone it down and not do it every match or maybe ever. anything you want to add to that, Eric?
I mean, there's two schools of thought. There's in among wrestling fandom, especially hardcore wrestling fandom. They're all grown men and women and they get to choose what they do with their bodies and you shouldn't be the move police. And then there's the school of thought that you got to save people from themselves because guys were taking unprotected chair shots in the 90s and they've got memory loss or concussion problems, right? That school of thought says that you should penalize the match ratings of Will Ospreay and Kenny Omega when Ospreay does a risky tiger driver, whatever year it is. It's apparently a dispute after listening to everything with Rich Fan. Famously Dave Meltzer of the Wrestling Observer, I think he docked a half star from a Tetsuya Naito Kota Ibushi match 4 or 5 years ago when they were just dropping each other on their heads with suplexes in very dangerous fashion. And then obviously there's the 90s All Japan crew.
And boy, did that teach them.
Yeah.
And when you get a half star taken off, you know you better check yourself and not do it again.
And so I guess whatever side you come down on, I don't think it's maybe that's fine for somebody who's in their athletic prime, but I don't know, 64-year-old guy shouldn't be doing that. That's just where I draw the line.
I think that's entirely reasonable. All right, Todd, JD in Detroit says, hi, team. Do you think Blood and Guts, along with another surprise, perhaps a Mercedes Moné appearance, would be enough to sell out TD Garden in Boston? Yeah, I mean, obviously they want to bring a big match to a big city and circle it on the calendar and try to pop a rating. A Mercedes Moné, formerly Sasha Banks, signing and announcing it ahead of time would be huge. If tickets go fast enough and you just want to surprise fans with it, that'd be great. I haven't heard if that's in the works, but obviously there's, you know, interest on AEW's part. I don't think they have any reason to not think that she would be a difference maker. When we talk about the women's division, you know, with all due respect to, you know, Saraya and Ruby Soho and Toni Storm, and for that matter, Britt Baker and Chris Statlander and Jamie Hayter, you know, the former Sasha Banks would be the biggest star on the female side to step in that ring, period, for AEW. I'm curious what they draw at that big arena, Eric. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's going to be Mercedes yet because she severely injured her leg or ankle in a match against Willow Nightingale on a New Japan Strong card in, you know, from California in May, I think, which is why Willow Nightingale, they called an audible in that match, and that's why Willow Nightingale is walking around with the NJPW Strong Women's title, which was another belt that probably didn't need to exist in New Japan or, you know, but now it's there. I think putting the Blood and Guts match will be a big draw, though, that TD Garden show. I was trying to look up in my deleted items what the presale drew from WrestleTix data, but I couldn't quickly find it. I think probably 4,000 or 5,000. I want to say at the high end would be the high end, but I could be thinking of New Jersey show that's coming up as well.
Yeah. All right. Number two, do you think it is possible that MJF and Adam Cole do eventually win the tag tournament and possibly the tag titles even if the storyline is ultimately leading to a title match between the two. Eric, what do you think? Would you do that? Do you think they might do that?
I hope they don't do that. Just because I mean, the tag team division is kind of not exactly at a high point these days. When was the last time FTR even defended the belts? They don't seem to be building, you know, those kind of big tag title feuds or people vying to climb up the ladder to get a tag team title shot. But I don't think the answer is this weird, goofy battle bowl style blind eliminator tag team tournament. You would think that they make it to the finals and there's some sort of precipitating angle that causes MJF to really fully heel on Adam Cole and set up their presumed title match and all in London.
Number three, Jungle Boy ditched his babyface entrance after less than a week of being a heel. Jericho has never changed his entrance once after multiple heel face turns. That being said, I do think Jungle Boy gave off some great heel energy and had one of his better promos tonight as a heel. Perhaps it was the right move. What do you think about dropping the music, JB doing that, and Jericho not?
I think it was a smart move for Jack Perry to drop that song because that's a super babyface song. And I was like, oh, my notes were, oh, he still has the song. And then, seconds later, he ditches it. The difference is Chris Jericho is trying to sell rock albums, and that's one of his own Fozzy's songs. So I'm guessing – plus it's – you know, Jericho clearly loves the fans singing along, right? Even as a heel, he's smiling in the ring when they're doing it, right? He's soaking it up.
Yeah, there's a little bit of meta, like, yeah, all right, sing my song, and then I'll go into heel mode afterwards. And it's part of, you know, it's I think more than waving your arms in the air to Tarzan Boy, I think singing Judas is something people want to be in the crowd and be part of, and I think they think the trade-off is worth it. To give fans that chance, even if it undercuts the notion that people feel like Jericho is a despicable heel who ought to be booed. Number four, I think the OC is currently the only talent in the business who could possibly pull off the choosing of his Trios partners for the Trios match tonight. That being said, I wish there had been more thought into putting that match together. What'd you think of Cassidy being taught math and how many partners to have and how that was put together?
I mean, it was a social media angle, right? I mean, I think that's... It was a produced angle, but like where they aired video on social media, maybe, and they announced it today, or maybe they just showed the video tonight on Dynamite after the fact. That match was kind of rough in spots. It couldn't really, you know, it given the level of talent in the ring, heels who can bump, and you know, dynamic baby faces in Orange Cassidy and Vikingo. One of the big sub-headlines tonight was Keith Lee is dyeing his hair again. Did you see that, Wade?
That is not one of the headlines tonight.
Sub-headlines, I said.
Oh, yeah, fair enough.
And apparently I missed this during the Excalibur speed reading 60 seconds of the week, but I was all ready to ding AEW for promising they would say more about the Blind Eliminator Tag Team Tournament and then failing to do so. And I missed it. It came during the Excalibur rundown. Keith Lee and Swerve Strickland are teaming up against Orange Cassidy and Darby Allin. Wade, what are the odds of Keith Lee and Swerve Strickland, the former tag team champs, being picked together? About as good as
Jericho and Adam Cole, right?
And MJF. Yeah, exactly.
Like, it's one out of 142, I think, is the exact statistic. I don't know how many people are in that, are rolling around in that bin, but 1 in 142, I think, are the odds.
But you will notice that Keith Lee did get there was a Keith Lee chant with the whoops going tonight. So,
yeah.
And I wrote down in my notes rather snarkily, maybe we will finally get the Keith Lee Swerve Strickland singles match after, 9 months of using it? Because they seem to drop it, and now they seem to be going back to it. And Keith Lee did get the win tonight, which to me is a sign he's losing their singles match against Swerve if it ever happens.
And finally, it may be an overused term, but that Ruby Soho promo was cringeworthy and seemed to get a rather apathetic reaction from the crowd. It was a meandering diatribe. Yeah, that wasn't great. It did not have a rhythm to it in a crescendo. you know, just leaning on the top rope and chatting. It felt like what you would do if you were at a commercial break. You had your ring entrance, and then, you know, you go to a long commercial break, and you just lean on the top rope and yell to the fans. It didn't, you know, quite come across as the dynamic, you know, value every minute of TV time type energy you look for. I didn't think it was awful, but I think meandering was a synonym of that might have come to my mind a little bit.
I mean, maybe it was a little long. In Ruby's defense, Tony Khan didn't announce until, I think, or I don't think I saw, I think maybe until right when they went on the air that Britt Baker would not be wrestling tonight. And so maybe Ruby didn't have a ton of time. Maybe she only had 90 minutes to pull something together.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's not no time. I think you could come up with something in that time. And you know, if Cole and Britt have kids, they'll be weak little asses. Was that her line?
Weak. I don't think it was little ass something. Weak something. Weak. Oh, weak little bastards is what she said. I think.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. I guess it's better than weak little asses. But the idea of making fun of your future, you know, the kids or future kids of your opponent just feels kind of not even low hanging fruit, but just sort of like, I don't know. But I mean, you know, saying Baker said, I don't know who I am. Well, I wasn't any good then. And now, you know, get to know me now because I love who I am now. That rang sort of true, but saying Britt Baker's a shell of her former self just feels kind of random. Like, how is she a shell of her former self? Why is that a talking point? So, I don't know.
And then if you beat her next week, oh, big deal, you've beaten the shell of a former self,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
You know what if Ruby really wanted to bring the heat, what she should have said in her promo, you know, while we were all waiting in Toronto for Collision, Britt and Adam Cole were out in the Pacific Northwest at some sort of Comic-Con show, some sort of fan fest, hobnobbing with the fans where nobody's wearing a mask because everyone thinks we're past COVID. And, you know, then what do you know? They get sick and both of them can't wrestle in their matches. That would have been ribbon on the square, shooting on the square. Yeah, something like that. Yeah, she should have said that.
There you go. You've got a job waiting for you if you want one. Right, women's promos. All right, so up next, I didn't mean that as a dig. It was a transition, a neutral transition.
I know. That's how I took it.
good. Azan in St. Louis says, what do you think of Vikingo's appearance in AEW lately? Do you think Tony will sign him to a contract?
I don't know what his actual status is. I think he might be under contract with the promotion here. Is that AAA? Yeah, he's the AAA champion. AAA champion. So I don't think it is possible for Tony to poach him just yet like he did with Commander.
I think if you sign him, or if you, you know, it's sort of like the frustration with Bandido. It's like, or Penta and Ray. It's like, really, don't just drop him in to hit some spots and be exciting. Like, figure out how fans should feel about him. Not just pop the crowd with big spots. Like, put them in a situation to be part of something that feels important and where a win or a loss is part of a progression in their character's journey. And I just don't think any type of thought is being put into him, but that's true with a lot of wrestlers in AEW who, you know, are out there because they're exciting, but there's just no density to the booking.
Yeah. My hottest, scorchingest hot take of all is Tony Khan is not doing significantly better in booking his Mexican stars than Eric Bischoff did in late 90s WCW. There's not the obvious racism that was going on there, but they are basically used as really, really talented enhancement guys when they're not wrestling themselves in really exciting matches. Yeah.
What do you think about Anthony Bowen's moment on last Friday's Rampage? They replayed that tonight, Eric. You think I'm into you? I'm gay. And then the crowd laughed and smiled and clapped, and it is not 1983. I thought that was a cool moment for Bowens to say that and get the crowd reaction that it got. It seemed, like you would expect in AEW, a progressive crowd, thinking the joke's on the woman who thought a gay guy was into her.
Yeah, I was there in the building. There was this pesky veteran wrestling newsletter editor who kept texting me and pestering me to step out of the Rampage table and call in. Yeah. But I did see that, and they definitely edited the you could not hear Harley Cameron in the arena because she was drowned out by booze, as in, we don't want you to do this segment, booze. And they edited that out, right? They to use the sound machine to turn that sound down. It was very heartening and hilarious at the same time. It was heartening that, you know, wrestling crowds from when I was a kid would not, you know, Adrian Adonis got heat for a reason, right? And it wasn't, you know, wasn't a reason you'd want to boo the guy in 2023. And so it was both the heartening of reaction of it, of the fans siding with Bowens and treating the fact that he said he was gay on national TV as a wrestler positively, and just the "he's gay" chant. It's just such a ridiculous chant, but like it was hilarious. I greatly enjoyed that part of the segment, and the rest of it, throw it in the bin and never make me watch it again, because it was terrible.
Did you sense any negativity towards, like, why are people cheering this guy? Like, any?
No, like, I didn't get any of that at all. No.
Yeah. All right. And then third is, can we take a moment to talk about tonight's show? The show would work better if they cut some time on promos and went with the old TBS format of 1 to 3 minute promos. What do you think of just kind of in a macro sense tonight specifically, but also broad in and out, the way that AEW features and produces promos? Eric, we've been watching wrestling long enough. We've seen a lot of companies do them in a lot of different ways, in a lot of different contexts. Is AEW mixing and matching well with the backstage Renee interviews and Alex Marvez on occasion and Lexi Nair, and then also, you know, solo promos in the ring and then featured promos with Tony Schiavone? I think they're mixing it up pretty well. But I'm not against more mic time, more people getting mic time that's shorter so that they just get to the point. Like, some would say that about callers on call-in shows, you know, like get to your point, know what your point is and efficiently hit it. And, you know, and keep things moving. You know, that's what that makes for good talk radio. That's always, you know, been a thing growing up and listening to talk radio over the years. And there's something about the pace of things where if you hear from more people and they have that go-to promo, that 1, 2, 3 minute promo, that should be a skill that they just have. You know, it's like, what do you say? Oh, you know, everybody should have one or two good jokes for a party. Like, every wrestler should have, you know, one or two solid 2 minute promos that they can tweak for the circumstances. And we grew up watching those. You know, the AWA was famous for great ones. You know, Jesse Ventura and Mad Dog Vachon and Crusher Blackwell. They were great at that. And I'm not saying it's a lost art, but it's maybe a lost art, Eric.
Well, Wade, I certainly would not join you in burying your listeners by suggesting that they cut to the chase more quickly, since they're the folks, by and large, who pay for Torch HQ. So you can go ahead and bury your readers and VIP members.
They know who they are.
I think it is. I agree with you that it's a good mix, and I'm a firm believer in life professionally. Set people up to succeed. You know, help them cover up their weaknesses if they have them, and accentuate their strengths. And I think what that generally looks like in AEW is you don't give a live mic to people who aren't ready for it. And during the builds for Double or Nothing, they were doing that a lot with the four pillars, right? Only maybe one and a half of which who were ready to talk with a live mic. Darby got better though when he got more reps. Jack Perry's either going to get better, or he's going to sink or swim. He's not going to get better. They don't usually. So who gets the live mic? It's Punk. It's MJF. It's John Moxley. It's Chris Jericho. It's people who can carry a live 10-minute promo segment in the ring, right? And that's smart. That's the way you should be doing it. You know, you generally don't see Kenny and the Bucks doing that because it's not one of their strengths. Their strengths are, you know, doing 5-star matches. So I agree. Good mix.
All right. Anything else from tonight's show, Eric, that we didn't cover, the listeners and emailers didn't cover, that you want to bring up?
I just thought it was hilarious during the main event that Chris Jericho was about to blade, and they zoomed in on him until somebody in the production truck realized, oh, crap, we better not show Chris Jericho blading. And then sure enough, he comes up a couple seconds later, and he is ready to, you know, he's bleeding. Let's see. I think
they're amateurs. I tell you, amateurs.
Yeah, I think you just got to know us, you know, a spot's coming and take the shot that's of anything but the guy who's about to blade. No, I think that is about it on my end.
Yeah, I got nothing else, and if I do, I'll cover it in the Keller Hotline for VIP members when I run on the show start to finish after we wrap up here. Eric, thanks. It's always fun talking to AEW with you.
Thanks for having me.
What would you think of Forbidden Door?
I really, really liked it. My match of the year is number one is Omega and Ospreay from Forbidden Door. Two is Omega and Ospreay from Wrestle Kingdom. So,
yeah. What'd you like better about Forbidden Door? Elaborate.
It just went longer, and they did even more than they did in January, and it had, you know, just had layers, and it had, you know, Kenny Omega protecting his finisher by kicking out at one, the one-winged angel, and
yeah. It's like the person with a submission hold who knows how to counter it. So it's like you get out of your own submission hold because you practice it so much. Like you know how to absorb your own finisher or something, so you kick out at one.
Yeah, I think in Japan they did the match that was suited for Japan, and in America they had more interference, which probably soured some people on it. You know,
Gallus
coming yeah. back. And I'm what is it? Wednesday, so 3 days later, I'm still mad at Bryan Danielson for his convulsion spot. And I know if you asked him at the press conference, I'm sure he would have said, hey, look, I'm going to do that. I'm going to play on people's emotions. I don't like it personally. And even if what I think doesn't matter, what mattered was it killed the crowd for a good several minutes. And Bryan Danielson on Sunday had to resort to doing the yes chant bit, which I don't think he necessarily likes to do in AEW, to get the crowd back, because he killed them dead with his fake convulsion bit. And I know he's going to, if you asked him, he'd probably say, I'm a heel, I'm going to do what I can to piss off the fans, but that's not what happened, because the fans don't really view him as a heel, right? He's beloved Ric Flair level of, you know, industry icon, and sure, he's playing a bad guy, but everyone's super concerned about his health in particular, given how many years he was out, and I'm mad. I'm still mad about it.
Well, and you shouldn't be a heel for, in a meta sense, pretending that one injury is real and the rest aren't, and then knowing people are going to resent you for it, so that's being a heel. Like, you got to – that's not the craft of heel, of being a heel in wrestling. It is tricking people into thinking you're dying or, you know, seriously hurt and they're going to have to call off the match. Like, that's just cheap heat. It's modern-day cheap heat.
Suppose if it led to him – winning the match, like he, you know,
tricked.
Yeah, like Okada got rolled up and that was the pin. I guess you could say that was okay to do because he put the heat on the finish, but that's not what it was. It was just, yeah, it took me out of the match emotionally, and they were going to have a hard time living up to expectations following Omega and Ospreay, and just, you know, and then unfortunately, he broke his arm in a, you know, freak accident. Not tucking his said he didn't tuck his arm in on the elbow drop off the top. So, yeah, you hope you
amateur.
You know they're probably going to have a rematch, and it's probably going to be a big match in Japan, and Okada's probably going to go over, and I, you know, whenever that takes place.
Any issues with the match order or the booking of the show in terms of finishes and match length and all that? Is there any kind of tweak you would make to the overall big picture?
It's been a few days. It felt a little long, and I don't know if that's because I watched the pre-show and, you know, watched the four matches or what, but it definitely felt a little long. You might have cut a match. I don't remember. They did end up, you know, they end up cutting Adam Cole and Tom Lawler. So, nothing's coming to mind of what else they could have cut though, but you know, just if they'd have brought it in at a nice ending at 10:30 Central, 11:30, that just feels better from a fan standpoint.
Yeah. Yep. Very good. Well, we'll wrap up there. Thanks, Eric. Once again,
thank you.
You bet. Take care, everybody.